Play to Potential podcast.
Welcome to the second conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. This is Deepak Jayaraman here, the creator and curator of this podcast series. Joining us this time is Amish Tripathi, a celebrated author who needs no introduction. Known for his Shiva trilogy and Sign of Ishvaku, first in the Ramchandra series. I've been keen to speak with Amish because of the successful transition he's made from the corporate world to the world of writing books. He's an alumnus of St. Xavier's in Mumbai, and I'm Calcutta, and spent about 14 years in the financial services world in companies like Standard Chartered Bank, DBS Bank, IDBI Federal Life Insurance, before starting his writing career. In our conversation, we spoke about how this transition panned out for him, how he leveraged his business skills to market his books creatively, and some lessons the business world can learn from some of the ancient works. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Amish, thank you so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Thanks.
And again, as a fellow IIM alumnus who's led a reasonably predictable path, having done consulting for a while, I've always been curious about the transition you made from the world of financial services to being an author. So looking forward to this conversation. Maybe the good place to start is, Amish, if you could give us a sense of where the seeds of this transition were sown.
If you're looking for the seeds in my childhood, frankly, they don't exist. I was never creative when I was young. In fact, most of my school and college friends, even friends from IIM, Calcutta, when they meet me, they usually say, "Sach pata, actually, kisne likha hai?" I was academically oriented when I was young. I was also active in sports, so boxing, gymnastics, those kind of things. But I never did anything creative. I never wrote anything. I never wrote any fiction before The Immortals of Meluha. I never wrote any music. I was the singer of our band in IIM Calcutta, but I never wrote the music. We only performed what others had written.
Okay.
So I was never creative at all. So I think the seeds are to be found perhaps in an incident that happened 11, 12 years ago. When my family and I, we were watching TV and we discovered something interesting, and a philosophical discussion ensued. And that was the genesis of the Shiva trilogy. It was a philosophical discussion into the nature of evil.
Okay. In the family?
Yeah, in the family, yeah. My family, my grandfather was a pandit in Kashi. Mm-hmm. Both my parents are deeply religious, so we have an atmosphere in our family of our myths, of our scriptures, of discussions, debates on it. In our family, we also read a lot. Everyone reads a lot.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of
my
stuff?
My siblings. I primarily read non-fiction. Everyone has their own favorite genres. My favorite genres are history, spirituality, philosophy, religion, science, politics. I read books in this genre. I read maybe at least 5-6 books every month.
Wow.
I've been reading at that pace for decades. So started reading maybe when I was 5-6 years old. Everyone in my family, my siblings, everyone, we must have at least 1,000 book library at home. We all read a lot.
Wow.
And we discuss and debate a lot. So I guess that was the atmosphere.
But having a debate to writing a book, that's still a pretty big leap.
Long journey.
Long journey, indeed. So walk us through just how that phase panned out for you.
Yeah, like I said, it was essentially a philosophical discussion on the nature of evil, on what is evil. It was based the discussion was based on a TV program that we saw, and we discovered something interesting. We all know that for Indians, gods are called devas and demons are called asuras. We all know that. What many of us don't know is that for the ancient Persians, not the Islamic Persians, the Zoroastrian Persians,
mm-hmm.
The gods were called ahuras and the demons were called daivas. Their pantheon is the exact opposite of the Indian pantheon. So Indra, king of the gods among the Indians, is one of the chief demons among the ancient Zoroastrian Persians. And which triggered an interesting discussion in our family. There, the ancient Indians and the ancient Persians had met. We'd probably be calling each other evil, because your god is my demon, my god is your demon. You must be evil. So who'd be right? Would the ancient Indians be right or would the ancient Persians be right?
Mm-hmm.
The obvious answer is neither. They're just two radically different points of view. But neither of them are evil. They're just different. Evil is something that exists beyond petty human rivalries.
Sure.
So an answer occurred to me, to that question, that what is evil? Based partly on, on some of the Upanishads that I've read and that I've learned from my family, and based somewhat on my own thoughts, So I told this philosophy to my family. They said they liked it, and I was encouraged to write it down as a thesis. So that's how it began, actually, a pure philosophy thesis, an answer to the question, what is evil?
And when you wrote it at that time, what, in your mind, who was the audience for that? Was it just as a vent?
No, yeah, it was just for me. I wasn't really... Look, I was a banker, man. I mean, no one wants to listen to bankers, let's be honest. And a banker, going with a philosophical thesis on what is evil, they'll say, yeah, you bankers are evil. I was just writing for myself and for my family, that's it.
And this was in addition to your day job as a banker?
Addition to my day job. Mm-hmm. And of course, slowly that thesis got converted into an action-adventure book. The idea being that through a hopefully engaging story, I'll communicate at the root of it is the philosophy of what is evil. And I'm trying to communicate that through this adventure, through this story. And that's how it panned out.
And picking up from there, Amish, from writing for yourself to writing a book that gets published, what was that journey like?
When I write, I don't really care. Even now, when I write, I'm not really thinking about how it will be received by readers, critics, publishers, or anyone else, frankly. Mm-hmm. This is how I wrote my first book, and this is how I write today as well. Mm-hmm. I can't say it was a conscious choice when I was writing my first book, because I wasn't even really thinking that it would get published. I guess without realizing it, I was following what Lord Krishna tells us in the Bhagavad Gita, karmanya vadikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana, that you have a right to your karma, not to the fruits of your karma. And we in the modern world have interpreted this wonderful philosophy to mean something fatalistic, which is not what Lord Krishna was telling us. What he was telling us is, actually, if you're detached from the results of your karma, if you're detached from success or failure, then actually you're unstoppable. If you're doing something simply because you love doing it, simply because you enjoy your karma so much, who can stop you? Because failure can, of course, be demotivating, because it fills, sadness, grief, sure, demotivation in your heart, and it stops you.
Sure.
But success can be as dangerous, because you'll find so many people who are one-hit wonders because success fills pride in their head, and they lose their way. But if you're detached from success or failure, then actually you're unstoppable, because you'll just keep doing what you love doing. And I'm not saying I'm this great philosopher and I consciously figured this out. It's just that I loved doing anything with my book so much that I genuinely didn't care whether it succeeded or not. I wasn't really thinking whether it'd get published or not. I just loved doing anything associated with my books.
And what was the tipping point for you, Amish, to say this could be a full-time career? At what point did you leave the banking job?
It was a pragmatic decision. Look, I come from a middle-class family, okay? So I always joke ki, bhai, mere paas baap dada ka ashirwad hai, jaidat kuch nahi. So I have to be pragmatic and practical in my career decisions. I have responsibilities, I'm blessed with a child, I have a wife. So I resigned only after my second book, when my royalty check became greater than my salary check. And even at that time, I was a member of the senior management committee at IDBI Federal Life Insurance. Uh-huh. So hence I was not just involved with projects in my department, I used to look after marketing, product development and service quality for the company. But I was also involved in projects of other departments.
As a part of the leadership team?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I made sure I gave my boss a very long notice pay. I completed all my projects, including ones that I was involved in with other departments. I found my replacement and I trained him. Took him to SMC meetings for a few things so that he was, he got into the groove of it. And I resigned only at that time. My boss threw a farewell party for me, gave me a lovely, very large idol of Lord Shiva as a gift. And so I left on very good terms with him. And I told him at the farewell party also, Sarji, kal kuch gadbad ho jaye, toh main wapas aa jaunga naukri
mein. So you had the hedge.
I would say it's being pragmatic. I mean, some people may call it boring. I call it being pragmatic.
Sure.
If you don't have family wealth to fall back on, you have to be practical in your career decisions. I always believe, why burn bridges? You know, if you can maintain good relations, what's the harm? You never know when you need a bridge. And even karmically, I think it works. You know, why attract negative emotions from anyone if you can leave people with good positive emotions?
True.
It's good. You know, unless you're forced to fight, then you shouldn't be a coward. Then if you have to fight, then you have to fight.
That's a different discussion.
That's a different discussion. But as far as possible, you know, even if you're leaving a relationship, leave on good terms. That's the way I see it.
The first book, again, I understand you had a bunch of rejects before you got your first publisher.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of stuff that's been written about grit and determination and all that stuff. But just tactically speaking, practically speaking rather, where do you get your energy to deal with failure? That if we specifically looked at that passage of play?
I'll go back to, if you're doing something that you love doing so much, you know, you genuinely, failure does not demotivate you. Now, I'm not saying that you should be impractical.
Mm.
Like for me to react to that failure by leaving my job and saying I'll commit to this full time and then realize at the end of 3 months I don't have any money to pay my bills, that would turn the books, which was a source of joy for me, into a source of of frustration and grief. So I always suggest that you should use your heart to decide the destination, but use your mind to plot the journey. So I was very clear that I was not going to give up on my book, no matter what, no matter how many people rejected it. I was going to do everything that I could to make it work. Aage chale na chale bhagwan ke upar hai. But I will do my best. That I was very clear on.
Sure.
Now that was the destination that my heart had decided. So but what should the journey be to that? I allowed my mind to make up my mind. Which is, I allowed my mind to make up my decision.
Sure.
Which is why I did not resign from my job. Which is why I invested only into the marketing of the book. But I invested only what I could afford from my salary. I didn't take loans from anyone. I of course didn't ask any of my relatives, anyone for anything, only my money. I invested only what I could afford.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky that I had family support for this. My wife, my siblings, because, if you don't have that emotional support, it's not about financial support, it's that emotional support.
True.
Then that can kind of, draw energy away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And, that family support is extremely crucial. And of course, I'm lucky in that sense, but I would also say that it's a responsibility of each individual to try and get that support, to enroll people around him into his journey.
It's a good point. Whether it's family or the organization, as you say,
anyone, right? it's your job to figure out how you can get them motivated in your journey. Because frankly, it's not their journey. Why should they care so much about you? So you have to figure it out. And my family was, of course, very supportive because they could see how this book had changed me. It had changed my character by 180 degrees, and they were extremely supportive. And that's a big part.
In what sense, if I may ask, when you say change your character by 180 degrees?
I was, you're an IM guy. You know how we tend to get in the corporate world. We can be, very hyper-competitive. We can be, frankly, unnecessarily aggressive.
Yeah.
We are benchmarking all the time. You go to an alumni meet. Oh, this guy is
sizing up.
You're sizing up. Oh, this guy's still at this level, loser. Oh, this guy's at that level, shit, I got to work harder.
Yeah.
Whatever bonus you got, you always felt you were underpaid. When you moved into a cabin, you'd feel, no, I deserve a bigger cabin. When you got a personal assistant, I deserved a better personal assistant. Yeah. When you got a promotion, I should have got it 2 years earlier. There's never any calmness, Now, I'm not saying you should not be competitive. You can't be someone who just sits around, wastes his life drinking, alcohol on a beach. I mean, that's not a productive life. Of course, you should be competitive, but you need to understand how to keep that calmness within you as well.
True.
It should not become a source of, just frustration and endless dissonance, which frankly, many of us in the corporate world, we do behave that way. Let's be honest.
Correct. And a lot of the incentives often are designed
to
motivate
RG behavior. Career.
Exactly.
We are trained that way from B school itself.
Correct.
I have changed dramatically from that pose. I'm far calmer than I used to be. I don't shout. I used to shout a lot in my corporate career. I'm sure my teams must have hated me. I think the only way, I guess, I used to motivate them is I would ensure and fight and get good increments and bonuses for them at the end of the year. But now I'm not like that. I don't shout and scream as much as I used to. I'm far calmer than I used to be. I'm much happier than I used to be. And strangely, I'm doing better in every other way as well, financially and everything. But you realize actually you don't need to be a hyper competitive nutcase, you know, to get results.
Sure.
You can actually be calm inside and still be competitive.
True.
That balance is possible.
A lot of people, there's this romantic notion of becoming an author, right? And like in any profession, there's always this grass is greener on the other side, right? You always see the upside.
What kind of grass are you talking about?
That's a different discussion for a different day. But the point I'm trying to get to the bottom of is give us a sense of the reality of writing, right? What do the highs look like? What do the lows look like?
Look, one thing someone, you know, anyone who wants to get into any creative field, you have to be clear of that the rewards are very skewed out here. It's not just in writing, but in films, in
it's
TV,
a large career, yeah.
In artists, painters, creative. Musicians, any creative field. You'll have a few people making money that's beyond their dreams,
right?
Beyond their wildest dreams. And you'll have a large number not even making enough to get by. That's the nature of the creative sector.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be clear of that before you get into it. Unlike, say, banking or IT or, you know, any proper corporate career where you can make a career and everyone can do, some people will do very well, but everyone can do reasonably well and you can get by. So you have to be aware of these risks when you get in. And very few people can actually predict what will work and what will not work. In the creative field, I mean, nobody really knows. One of the main reasons my books were rejected is because before Immortals of Meloa, most mythological fiction novels were simply not working. They were flopping. So which is why in the English language, which is why my books were also rejected by publishers. To everyone's surprise, my books did well. So you have to be aware of that. And I always advise there's no harm in having another job.
Mm-hmm.
While pursuing a writing career on the side.
That's interesting. I think, what your approach was, let this sort of keep...
keep the soul alive.
Keep the soul alive and let it grow.
Have a job to keep the body and soul together.
And at some point, when this grows at a certain point...
Yeah. Then it's a pragmatic call. Mm-hmm. But you have to realize that many people don't make it. It doesn't mean that anyone is better or worse. It's just, you know, right time, right place. Of course, there are, you know, there's the blessing of God, the skills involved, but there's, you know, there's also just sheer luck here.
But for the first time writers, for a minute, given the initial hurdles you had to cross till you got the first publisher, any lessons learned? Would you have done anything differently with the wisdom of what you've gone through?
No, not really. Because I tried everything that I could. And in fact, I believe that the rejections that I faced from mainstream publishers, from all publishers actually, was actually a blessing in disguise. Because I was free to market the books the way I want to. The publishing industry is not the most innovative when it comes to marketing. There's this attitude of, yaar, ye toh pehle kabhi kiya nahi hai, toh ye naya kaise kar sakte hai?
Mm.
You know, so which frankly is one of the most irritating lines in the world, that we've never done this before, so we can't do it. You know, I mean, that's the worst reason.
And it's in a creative field to see this, it's ironic.
But,
right?
Yeah, but it is the way the industry is, especially when it comes to marketing. So actually, it was a blessing in disguise because we could do innovative things.
Amish, you spoke about the fact that you hadn't had any background in writing, right, leading up to this. But just back to the point about pragmatism, what are the questions people should ask themselves before committing to a direction in writing, right? I'm sure there are, like in any profession, there are some capabilities or competencies, as I say. In your sense, what does it take to become a good writer, fiction writer?
I think the first step is, do you actually enjoy it? This is not something that you should take up just because you think it'll make you famous or it'll, you'll make tons of money from it. Because if that's the purpose, there are other routes which are much more surer in the corporate world as well. I think the first thing you clearly have to answer is, do you actually enjoy it so much. Would you rather do this than do anything else? And for me, that answer was yes. For 7-8 years, I was actually working on my books, you know, writing, promoting, etc., and doing a full-time job at the same time. So I actually had very little free time. I was doing only 3 things for those 7-8 years, where it's essentially doing my job, working at my books, and spending time with my family. I did nothing else. Mm-hmm. And I was, and of course I was stretched for time, but I just loved writing, you know, spending time in that fictional world. I loved it so much that I couldn't think of doing anything else. So that is the first thing one must answer.
Mm-hmm.
Only your heart can answer that. It's not a pragmatic, balance sheet, assets, liabilities, opportunities and threats kind of discussion. No, only your heart can answer it.
But from a writing perspective, again, maybe to ask the question differently, a number of people set out to write. A number of passionate people set out to write, but some make it and some don't. When you look at the people that somehow don't make it, is there some sort of a pattern that emerges in terms of what doesn't work out for them?
Procrastination, yeah. See, you know, the you'll find so often, it happens in a large number of cases. Most of the writers who begin writing a book, most of them actually never complete it. Because remember, writing is not a team sport. Unlike many other creative pursuits as well, you know, like filmmaking. So you don't have others who are a part of the project who are driving you together. It's a benefit in the corporate world as well, right? Because you have an entire team together.
Everyone
momentum pushes you forward. Writing is in that sense a lonely profession, and you're sitting by yourself, and you're doing your thing. It's very easy to get distracted. It's very easy to lose momentum, and so many people simply don't finish their books. And you need to have that discipline. But that's what I meant when I said that discipline and that commitment only comes when you actually love it so much that you'd rather do that than anything else in the world. Because the chances of success are so low, the chances of even getting it published are so low. Then what can motivate you? There's no rational reason to motivate you to write a book or to paint. Even painting is in a sense a solitary profession. You have to just love it so much that you'll find every free time available and do it.
Amish, moving on, this is a broader point in even in the corporate world. I call it the deep work. Again, Cal Newport, who's a prof in the US, has written a book on it. And the reason I find it interesting is we live in a world where there's a tsunami of stimuli, right? Whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, whether it's news
channels.
Attention spans have collapsed. There's a bunch of stuff bombarding us. So talk to us about how do you create the space for you to write?
You know, on a lighter note, I was joking with my wife yesterday. Thank God we finished college before WhatsApp and Twitter came. Yeah. We would have flunked everything, man, because we'd be so distracted. I'd read this interesting case study that this was done in the US. So that apparently among the youth in the US, the attention span, average attention span on any one subject is 8 seconds now.
Wow.
Just to give you a sense of perspective, a goldfish apparently has an attention span of 9 seconds. Okay, so we are that distracted as a species now. Of course, US much more because of the nature of their media, but the rest of the world is also...
But order of magnitude is shocking. Yeah
it's... Now, in this distraction, how do you get productivity going? IT was supposed to be this great productivity enhancement measure, and I would say in many ways it's actually productivity destroying because we are so distracted. Which comes back to the thing that I said, that if you love doing something so much that actually you don't get distracted, and especially in a creative field. See, in the corporate world, you can have short bursts of attention span and still achieve some productivity. And like I said, the benefit of an organization, it has its own momentum. In the individual space, if you're doing something creative individually, I'd hammer that point even more. It's so easy to be distracted today, so easy.
So talking about rituals, again, if it's not confidential recipe, what do you do? How do you create that space for yourself? Is it a few days that you take off? Is it a certain point of a day? Just give us a sense of what rituals you use which help you write.
There are times when I take off on a writing break. More not because of, Twitter or things like that. But, if I'm in Mumbai, someone or the other will keep going for meetings and there are you know, something or the other which keeps happening. So I do that. I mean, I'll just take off for writing Oath of the Vahiputras. I took off to Kashi, to Banaras, and I was there for some 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. I hired a place. I lived out there. I cut off completely.
And no, with no communication at that time?
No, I don't do any meetings, nothing. I don't even, you know, tell anyone in there that I've... Okay. And then I just, it gives me a focus 3-4 weeks, and I can get a lot of momentum into my writing. Mm-hmm. So I try and do that. But I mean, during my writing phase, I write every day, even in the mornings at home. So that's one aspect. Taking those writing breaks gives some momentum. But as I said, in my writing phase, I write every day, even at home. I get up early in the mornings normally. Mm-hmm. I'm up normally every day by 5:30. I exercise, do my puja, and I start writing. Mm-hmm. I read 4 newspapers, sorry, every morning. Then I start writing, maybe my 9:30. I need music to start writing. That music kind of works like a key for me. It opens up that world.
Interesting.
The words themselves don't matter. The mood of the music is very crucial.
And any particular genre of music?
That I listen to all genres of music. Indian classical, Western classical, old Hindi film music, modern Hindi, indie pop. In Western music, I listen to rock, metal, world music, Indian regional language music.
So it's not just instrumental, it's music with words.
Yeah, music with words and all. Yeah, yeah. I don't listen to rap. That doesn't really connect to me.
Sure.
But any other genre of music, the mood is more important than the words themselves. And I eat lots of cream biscuits while writing. That works for me for some. I don't know, sugar rush perhaps.
That's a fascinating tactical input.
Yeah.
I don't know.
God knows if it'll work. There is. When I write, I tend to put on a lot of weight.
All right. Again, back to the point you alluded to, which is about writing for an audience of one, which is yourself.
Mm.
Again, at the end of the day, there is a commercial element which is important for sustenance.
Sure, sure.
How do you balance this whole inside out and the outside in terms of listening to what the market needs versus what the creative person in you wants to produce?
In the creative space, I believe there can be no outside in. Mm. There cannot be. There's only an inside out when you're writing. Mm. Now, outside influences could impact you in terms of, like, you're traveling and, you know, you see something and that inspires you.
Okay.
Or someone tells you something about the book and that makes sense to you. But you, by outside in, I mean you can't do market research and write a book. It doesn't work that way. You know, writing is in a sense a spiritual process, a creative process, and you have to kind of be in the flow, and that only comes when you open yourself up. If you're a believer like me, you'll believe it's Lord Shiva, or whichever god you believe in, blessing you with it.
Hmm.
If you're an atheist, you'll believe it's a universe blessing you, but it comes from somewhere outside, and you have to honor that blessing.
Hmm.
So while writing, there's no question of doing market research and writing. You write what feels right to you. Only once you finish the book, then you have to become a practical, pragmatic marketing guy. And you have to figure out, okay, how do I sell this? So the book itself cannot be touched. It cannot be changed.
Sure.
Except by the editor, like I said, obviously. I mean, if, you know, but and not for market research purposes. Okay. The book cannot be touched. And then you figure out, okay, now how do I market this? How do I position this? How do I sell this? Because ultimately, yes, a publisher has invested money in you as an author. It's your duty to make sure that publisher makes his money back. Yeah.
Hmm. And from there, again, even there, I'm told there have been a bunch of innovative things you've done in marketing the books. So talk to us about maybe two or three things that have been different about how you promote your books versus maybe some of the other authors.
I'll give you some ideas from my first book. I must clearly admit, though, that they weren't my ideas. You know, they were from my team. But perhaps my skill was in picking good ideas, you know, and getting it implemented. The first idea came from my wife, Preeti. You know, I always believe that marketing cannot exist as a discipline by itself. It cannot be just an area where your marketing team is essentially having fun. It has to serve the business objectives. So you have to be clear what the business problems are, what the business objectives are, and then how can marketing solve those problems. So what are the business problems for me as a debut author in 2010 and a self-published author? So I wasn't backed by any big publisher, so there's no way I could ensure availability and good display of books, of my books at stores. Chances are, a debut author, even of a big publisher, chances are your books are a well-kept secret at the store. Forget about readers, even the store staff wouldn't know that your book has been launched. You know, the carton wouldn't even get opened, it'd probably lie in some bathroom somewhere and get returned 6 months later. So how do I get display of my books? If it's not even displayed, how is it going to sell?
Yeah.
So this was an idea that my wife came up with. She said, and it was inspired from shampoos. You remember when the sachet revolution began? Yes. That was, you know, a decade, you know, more than a decade ago, 2 decades ago now. The bottle itself in those days used to cost, you know, maybe if you, in those days, 20 rupees or something. But the sachet would be, you know, 20 paisa, 25 paisa. Yeah. Okay, so the entire point was to induce trial. You know, because bottle is too much to invest in. So sachet, ya kya jata yaar, 25 paisa, le le, try kar le. If you like it, you might buy the bottle. So she said, why can't we do a sampler like this for a book? So we printed the first chapter of the book and put the same cover as the cover of the main book. And we distributed it free of cost.
Wow.
At retail stores. This had never been done before. And I went with a PowerPoint presentation to various retail chains, told them, you know, I'm giving you something free. What's the downside? Just distribute it free. They'd never seen authors come with PowerPoint presentations, so they agreed to that idea. To my surprise, they didn't charge anything.
Okay.
So now if you think about it, they displayed those booklets.
And these booklets were on the shelves or somebody was standing outside
the shelves?
It was
at the cash counter.
Oh, wow.
Now, if you think about it, it's prime display space, because that's where a serious customer is, because he's come to buy a book and he's got like, you know, 20, 30 seconds where he's waiting for his bill and waiting to pay.
Got him captive.
He has nothing to do and he sees this, you know, booklet out there with a very nice cover, you know, it's stamped free on top of it. Many of them picked it up and they went home and they read the first chapter and they came back and said, okay, now where's the book? And we launched this 2 weeks before the launch of the book. The initial response to the first chapter itself was so positive that many of these chain stores raised their order even before the launch of the book.
Wow.
And which is why the book hit the bestseller charts in the first week of launch. So this as an idea worked really well for us. But the key thing I always like to point out is you have to come out with a new idea. Because today, if you go to a bookstore and say, I have a free booklet, can you display it? They'll charge you for advertising space, which destroys the entire purpose of it.
That strategy is taken.
The strategy is gone because your costs have gone up. So your returns will not justify it. The second thing that we did for the first book was was a friend of mine called Abhijit. He suggested this idea to me that he said, your books are very visual. I can almost see the scenes, you know, the way you describe it. So he said, can we convey that to readers? Can we make a proper live action trailer film? Again, this had never been done before. As you can imagine, it was, you know, I had only my salary to invest, so I didn't have that much money. But we made a good trailer. We got a model, you know, shot him against a green chroma screen, put some then special effects on that chroma screen. We had music made by Taufik Qureshi ji.
Mm-hmm.
And we uploaded this on YouTube and this really took off, did very well for us. Again, this is something that had never been tried before.
From a timing perspective, this was before the launch as well? Or
Yeah, this was also before the launch. And it really went viral and did well for us.
Amish, let's talk about a different theme, work-life harmony. There's a professor in Wharton, Stuart Friedman, who talks about four dimensions. Mm-hmm. Yourself, home, work and society, mm-hmm. while taking stock of how you spend time. Mm-hmm. You talk about dharma, artha, kama and moksha. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of how you balance, what these are, help us understand these and also talk a little bit about how you balance these four dimensions in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, the dharma, artha, kama and moksha are, you know, are an ancient Indian philosophically. It was said that to have a successful life, you must have balanced the Purush Arthas. It doesn't mean Purush as in male, mm-hmm. but Purush as in the life force. The four Purush Arthas were this, Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha. Dharma is essentially, it's not religion, that's a wrong translation. Dharma is essentially the right way to live, the balance in the universe, that is. Values, etc. You know? Artha is wealth, power, fame, all of that put together. Kama is not just sex, but actually all the sensual pleasures of life. So mm-hmm. music, arts, drama, you should have all that in your life. And moksha is, of course, finding liberation. You must have a balance in all these four to lead a successful life. And for that, you must find balance with your swadharma, with yourself, and also with everyone around you. Because only then can you find a balanced life. Now, will there be times when you will be working very hard? Yes, I mean, those phases come in life. Now, you have to figure out how to make sure that you can, you don't leave your family or your friends with a sense that that you have cut off. That they should believe in, you know, in what you're doing. And No one manages this perfectly. You know, you have to. It's a journey, and you have to figure out how to do it. And there'll be phases when you may not have that much work, and you can, you know, spend time on various other aspects. The only point I'm trying to ensure, I'm trying to suggest, is that you must have this sense in your mind that you have to find this sense of balance. You'll never be walking on that exactly balanced path all the time, because if you were a soul like that, then you'd have hit moksha already. You know, you'd have been a Buddha. You'd have been you'd have been already with Lord Krishna and Lord Shiva and everyone else.
Yeah.
The fact that you're still here, it means that actually you haven't hit that that balance. And it's not that easy. But you can only achieve something when you actually have that in your mind, that I must find this balance.
Got it.
Yeah.
Moving to a different topic, Amish, which is about quickly, what are the lessons the business world can learn from some of these works? First is about culture, right? You talk about the Suryavanshi and the Chandravanshi way. Right. And again, it's interesting because any organization is trying to balance some sort of a process-driven approach and trying to create entrepreneurship, right, in terms of people coming up with solutions themselves. What's your take on how one could strike that balance in the context of creating culture?
You know, there's no... one of the things I try and communicate again and again in my books is there's no way that is better or worse. Each path works for a different time, for a different atmosphere. And ideally, and this is true of countries, this is true of companies, this is true of families, ideally you should be true to yourself. You know, like if we take, for example, in the case of a country, there are so many Indians who believe that we have to be like China. We cannot be like China. We are not like them because they are compliant people who follow what their, on average, follow what their government tells them to do.
The DNA is different, yeah.
We are a rebellious race. Indians will not follow what... we are by nature a very rebellious race. Mm-hmm. Even when we say yes, you know, our gestures are such that you're not really sure whether I will actually do what I've apparently accepted doing, you know, as an order you know, given to me. So we are a rebellious race. We are more Chandravanshi, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
No one is an exact Chandravanshi or Suryavanshi, but we are more Chandravanshi. The Chinese are more Suryavanshi. We should be true to who we are. Now, each way of life has its positives and negatives. The Suryavanshi way of life, at its best, is very efficient, very just, very focused. At its worst, it can be very rigid. It cannot handle change at all. It can become fanatical. The Chandravanshi way of life, at its best, is very freedom-loving, very creative, very passionate, very protective, especially of its weak. But at its worst, it can be very irresponsible, decadent, debauched. You have to be aware of the strengths and weaknesses of your way of life, and this will apply in your company as well. Your company will have a natural culture. The industry that your company is in will have a natural culture.
Sure.
There are some industries which are naturally, more Suryavanshi. There are some industries which are naturally more Chandravanshi.
Which attract a certain type of people.
Yep. And your customers will come in expecting that as well. Now, you as an individual may be exactly the same, but when you walk into a party, and if you find a guy or a girl with, you know, with hair dyed blue and with, you know, piercings and tattoos and God knows what not, and you'll probably find that guy fun, you know, and you'll chat with him and you'll, you know, but if you walk into your bank, you don't want to see a guy like that.
Hmm.
You want to see a guy with a perfectly knotted tie. You want to see a crew cut. You don't want any earrings. No tattoos. He has to be a sober state guy because that's what you expect in a bank.
Yeah.
Every industry has its own culture. You have to be in alignment with what that culture is and try and do the best that you can do within that culture. Organizations don't lay enough importance on how crucial culture is.
Yeah. So just wrapping up, Amish, a couple of quick questions. Given your experiences in the traditional corporate world and as an author, if you had to say three things that people should reflect on that they don't teach in business school, what would you say?
You don't have to be, you don't have to allow your hyper-competitiveness to cloud your inner happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me, you can actually be competitive and still be calm. Trust, I know it sounds counterintuitive, but it is possible. And if you are internally calm, you'll find you're even more productive. And more importantly, you're happier. I think this is one of the key things, and essentially life skills, not so much career skills, but life skills. But if you're not able to handle your own life, how will you handle your career well? And this is something that needs to be, that in ancient times was taught at a schooling stage itself through philosophies, but today it's not taught anywhere, including not in B schools.
Yeah.
So this is a very important part, how to manage your own life. The other thing is, you must try and find an alignment with your heart and your mind. I'm not one of those, those new age guys that, the hell with responsibility and the mind and, follow your heart and kick your boss. No, that's irresponsible.
Yeah.
Okay. But the B schools are on the other extreme, where you're supposed to sacrifice your heart completely, always be pragmatic, just focus on how to get the next promotion, the next bonus, focus on. And if you lose your heart, your sense of values, then you get the kind of scandals that you got in financial services industry, for example,
right.
In the West. So how do you balance your heart and your mind? Don't swing on either extreme. That is something that I think is worth learning, and worth learning from all ancient cultures, not just ancient Indian culture. It just so happens that ancient Indian culture happened to survive, that's all.
Sure.
Okay, but there's something to be learned from all ancient cultures.
Mm-hmm. And just wrapping up, this podcast series is called Play to Potential, mm-hmm. which is about people discovering their own uniqueness and pursuing a path which makes sense for them.
Mm.
In summary, one or two things you want to leave the listeners with in this context?
I think the best way to sum this up is this wonderful line from the Bhagavad Gita. Shreya Swadharma Vigunaha Paradharmat Shanushtathat. That is, it's better to do your own Swadharma, even if you make mistakes while doing it, rather than doing someone else's Swadharma, even if you do it perfectly. So the entire point what Lord Krishna was trying to tell us is find your own purpose and do that. Don't try and be someone else. Don't try and live a life that society has decided for you or anyone else may have decided for you. You must live your own life. You must, and only you can answer that question, what your purpose is in life. No one else can answer that for you. And then you find that purpose, pursue it, do it.
On that profound note, Amish, thanks a lot for being generous with your time and insights.
My pleasure.
Really, really insightful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Following your Swadharma with mistakes is better than following someone else's Swadharma perfectly. Powerful lines to conclude the conversation. Hope you found this purposeful. Thank you for tuning in. To follow the series, please follow the Twitter handle Play to Potential. Bye now, and hope to have you tune in to the subsequent conversations.